Hello and welcome to a new episode of Mere Fidelity, a podcast where we talk about the church in the culture. This week, and I think it's a first for Mere Fidelity, we bring you a 100% British podcast. Our esteemed colleagues Matt and Derek have gallivanted off to a big conference in the US, and Andrew and I are left to hold down the fort. But this week, we are privileged to be joined by Rachel Wilson, who is in fact a relative of Andrew, his wife. So together we'll be discussing Andrew and Rachel's new book, The Life You Never Expected, Thriving While Parenting Special Needs Children. Welcome to the show, Rachel. Would you like to kick us off by telling us briefly about the book and what prompted you to write it?
Oh, thank you. It's good to be here, Alistair. The book, really, we started writing it about 2 years ago. And it was really kind of born out of our experience of having 2 children with autism. And at the time when they were diagnosed, we were looking for something that was really a mixture between autobiography and theology, really something that ultimately was about clinging to Jesus when things got really tough. And we weren't able to find something at that time, so we decided to write one. So that's what we've done.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed the book. I found it very challenging. Obviously, I don't have any children, but even reading the book as someone who's single and without children, it is a great challenge for faith more generally, and it has a relevance for anyone who experiences struggles and difficulties and learning about the ways that these things can sharpen and hone and direct our faith in helpful directions. Can you tell our listeners a bit more about your children and what particular conditions they have? And how that has been, how that particularly prompted you to write the book.
Yeah, so we had our son Zeke in the November of 2008. In fact, it's actually his 7th birthday today. And everything seemed fine, really, until probably when he was 18 months, when we just became aware that he still wasn't hitting his 12-month milestones. But he was a very happy, chilled out baby, really, and so we weren't massively concerned. But when we started to look into things and he was then referred on, we realised really that we were on quite a different developmental curve. And after that, things seemed to improve. But at 2.5, all of those things, skills that he had gained, suddenly went into reverse, and he reversed through his milestones for the following 9 months and was diagnosed with autism at 3. His sister Anna was born when Zeke was 18 months old and seemed to be again developing fairly well, and at 12 months she started to have seizures and was diagnosed with epilepsy. So it was a really tough, intense time for us. Anna seemed to develop, once we'd got the epilepsy under control, seemed to be moving forwards quite positively, until again she hit 2.5 and went into reverse. Only her regression was much more severe, so she went backwards through milestones, losing language and motor skills and play skills, social skills, for the following 17 months when she was also diagnosed with severe autism as well. That's really been part of our story. We're very grateful that the children are moving forwards now, and their presentation of autism is fairly unusual, to regress that severely and to move backwards like that. But at both of their diagnosis appointments, we were told that they would always need a high level of support, that they would never live independently. Actually, we can see now with our son that he might confound some of those expectations. But certainly for our daughter, we're left with a 5.5-year-old who is more at a 12 to 18 month old level of development. So it's been a challenging time in terms of faith, in terms of parenting and marriage and just practical day to day life, really. And I think a lot of that rawness comes through in the book, and we've deliberately written it while things are still quite intense and quite recent and raw, and that was a deliberate decision, really, just to to kind of give our readers really a sense that we're very much feeling for God and purposes and in the dark and everything isn't sorted and there's not yet a happy ending, although we are in a much, much more positive place than we were when we actually began writing.
Thank you. I suppose if I were to take a single point away from your book after reading it, I think it might be that in situations of continued pressure or stress, we see that spiritual disciplines such as prayer, joy, thankfulness, the discipline of meeting together with other Christians, hope, love, patience, self-control, all of these sorts of things, they're not just pleasant spiritual activities, but they're the most essential practices for sustaining and preserving our life and sanity. They're core matters of basic survival. How would you both describe your experience in this respect?
I think the first thing, it certainly sounds great when you list them like that and think, yes, what a wonderful example of joy and hope and spiritual disciplines I am. But obviously it's not like that. It isn't normally, but it certainly wasn't when things were at their most intense. And so I suppose I think the opportunity to have time alone with God and calling out to him, whether it's through prayer, reading scripture, singing and worshipping and so on, I think has been huge lifelines for both of us, I expect, certainly for me. But it's not easy, because actually at the time when you most need those things, you actually also have the least access to them, because your family life is so chaotic. So I think I imagined my spiritual life starting the day, you know, a bit like when we were first married. I'll start the day like my dad always did and still does, and like I did before we had children, where you're able to have a nice quiet time in your whatever study bedroom, whatever, for 45 minutes before the day begins properly, and you get happy in God and bounce downstairs with your tail ups. You know, isn't God good and all this stuff, which is very much the way that my dad led our family, and I was hoping that that's what would happen with us. But it's just when you're up 3 hours before you want to be, which for quite a while we were, and even now it'd be sort of an hour and a half before you want to be, you're on the children when you are at sort of four something, or now it's more like five something, but still early enough that you're not really able to do a quiet time beforehand. And so that personal spirituality thing became a real pressure, because that's when I felt I most needed a devotional time with God. And I don't just mean a traditional quiet time thing. I mean reading scripture, reading books that were going to fuel joy in me and thankfulness and give me some perspective, really, and also the time to pray. None of those things were really available at the time when I wanted them. And then the easier life becomes, the more you get that time, but the less you actually need it, in a way, or so it feels, because you're not clinging on to God with your fingernails quite so desperately, because life is more manageable. And so you have time when you don't need it, and you don't have it when you do. That, I suppose, would be a way of summarising where I felt things were for me, and in many ways still are to a degree, and it's probably meant little bits of making the most of times like walking the dog, and the first few minutes in the office every day for me, which obviously I can do with my job, just finding God in those times to make sure that I don't just get knocked around by the day before it's even started. And I think actually when you talk about spiritual disciplines, in the vast majority of cases, even Rachel would probably say going to church, it is a spiritual discipline, but it's not very easy when your children are in a difficult place in regression, because they're so stressed by everything. So pretty much all of the examples of things you've just said are vital and yet very hard to maintain when you're in the middle of a difficult season like that with children. And I think I've kind of looked back at it now and think, well, yeah, we've made it, and God's been very good to us, and has sometimes we've got a lot of benefit out of a short spell. But a lot of the time it was actually very difficult, and I sympathise with if any of our listeners are in that situation. I kind of know where you're coming from.
Both of you mentioned at various points just the importance of the Psalms in these periods. How have you found your appreciation of the Psalms changing, and how important, in what ways have they been important in your lives?
I was just thinking that actually when you were asking about spirituality in that very dark time, and for me the Psalms were a real lifeline, partly because I was so tired but also so sad that I found it very difficult to read some of the books that I would normally find very comforting. So even following the logical pathways in Romans, I just got lost and bogged down, and I wasn't getting joy out of it. And I think for me, what I found most helpful about the Psalms was just how honest they were, and really like the element of lament that runs throughout them as well. And I think for a long time I tried to silver line things, and the last vibe you want to give off to people is that you're disappointed in your children. So it's very tempting to do a don't worry, be happy routine. But I found just by reading the Psalms that it was okay to be really, really sad, to be really confused, to not feel God sometimes, to not see his plan in any of it. And sometimes it was okay to worship through gritted teeth. And that was the impression that I got that some of the writers of the Psalms were doing sometimes as well. So that became a kind of the basis of really my cry out to God at that point, which can be summarized just with the word help, to be honest. There wasn't any deep Bible study going on at that point. It was really just a cry for help. And sometimes worshipping through gritted teeth and knowing he was there, even though I couldn't feel it sometimes.
I've also found, and similar to what you've described, that Psalms and other pieces of scripture can be particularly helpful at times like that, where we struggle to find our own words, that God has given us words to rest upon, that we can borrow, that we can bring back to him when we don't have the words to give situations ourselves.
Absolutely.
One of the first things I think many readers will recognise about your book is that it has penguins on the cover. Why is that?
I'm not 100% sure. I think probably it was prompted by an image we used, but there's a sort of an orange, certainly in the UK edition anyway, the American one looks a bit different. In the UK edition, there's an orange cover with a penguin on it, and I think both the orange theme and the penguins theme are both metaphors and symbols we wrote about in the book. Beginning the book with the image of being given an orange as a metaphor for having special needs children, when you get given an orange instead of a chocolate orange and all of your friends have got chocolate ones. And then we did a chapter, and I think an image that's helped me a lot is the emperor penguins, which I just from watching Planet Earth or David Attenborough or something like that, and you see these guys hanging in there in the middle of winter, and they pack together and they just put their heads down and they sit there in the freezing cold, Antarctic blizzards at minus 50 for month after month with these little eggs on their feet and wait for the light to break. They know it will because they've been there before and that's what they're bred to do. They know that in the end that it will get warmer again and the mothers will come back and the eggs will hatch and so on. But in the middle of the winter, there's just this desperate hanging on, just say, I've just got to stand here, I've got to wait until this passes. But they do it with, a beautiful picture of hope, because there's absolutely nothing in the landscape that would make it look like, you see, an Antarctic winter doesn't look at all like the sun's going to rise and it's going to get warm and pleasant. But as you see them doing it, they know from training and instinct and that sort of thing that the light breaks. They just have to hang in there until it does. And I think that for me is just a beautiful picture, not of special needs parenting as such, I suppose, of suffering in general and the biblical attitude of stubborn standing there until it gets better and hoping and hanging in there. And so, to connect the two questions, really, the one about the Psalms and the one about the penguin, I just found that the references in the Psalms to waiting, I wait for you, O Lord, more than watchmen wait for the morning, more than watchmen wait for the morning. The only way you wait for the morning is just by standing there and knowing that one day the light will come, and you just have to stand there until it does. And I think for me, the emperor penguins were a heroic example of that, that I've often thought of, and I think that's true in the journey we've been on with the children, but in lots of things, lots of other areas of life as well, just of standing there waiting. So I assume that's where they got the idea, but then I looked at it and I thought, oh, well, orange and penguin, maybe there's a little play there on the brand penguin and everything else as well. Maybe there's more to it. But when we saw that design, we really liked it because I think it expressed two quite big themes that we touched on in the book in quite a clever way.
Many of the struggles that you both describe, I suppose if they were to be described, many of them seem to be the experience of the frustrated expectations that our culture has cultivated within us, that we have, as it were, a certain life course that's set out before us that we expect that we're going to live. And then it's shaped around independence, autonomy, fulfillment, leisure, all these sorts of things. And this is very much kneaded into our very being that we expect this. But yet there are things that happen in life, or other events that overtake us that frustrate this expectation and force us to reevaluate what we think of as our vision for life. How have you found the experience of raising special needs kids changing your vision of life, the meaning of your own lives, but also of life more generally? And how have you learnt to take your bearings from sources other than the surrounding culture?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that we have all these expectations, and I don't think we ever felt like we were entitled to have children who didn't have special needs. But you sometimes those expectations can be quite subconscious, like you say, and influenced by the culture as well. And it's only as you realise that you're not going to have a child who perhaps gets married, or you're not perhaps going to have grandchildren, or a child who does GCSEs even, or leaves home in a normal way, that you suddenly realise you had all of these unspoken dreams, really. And I think it's been a really interesting, and actually at this point in the journey, quite a liberating experience for us to have had to create really a new sense of what is ordinary and what is joyful. And I would say it's really changed our priorities and our sense of what God values as well. And I think for me, some of the things that used to look really good written down on paper, whether or not that was in like a normal sense of a CV, or even a sense of a Christian CV, that we can have become less important. And sometimes the things that perhaps that God values more, about character and about kind of wasteful expenditure of love on very few people, sometimes it means for me, I'm often reminded of the story where Jesus commends the woman who pours out the perfume on his feet and says she'll be remembered. And I often think about that all of the time that we spend trying to get Zeke to eat a few spoonfuls of noodles, or all of the time that we're up in the morning or something, that we're with him or he's running laps, or any of those things, you think, we could have used that time to do this or do this ministry or do that ministry. And I think more and more we're kind of seeing that God's spreadsheet looks quite different to ours, and that the things that he values we might consider quite wasteful expenditure and love on very few people sometimes. And that, I think, is what caring for somebody really means. So yeah, it's been interesting. And actually, at the beginning, everything was quite painful, all of the normal experiences that we weren't going to have. Whereas now some of the quirky things about our kids that we actually find enjoyable and joyful and exciting, and their triumphs are so huge to us that we're kind of creating a new sense of what ordinary life is for our family. And it's a very different family dynamic, but it's becoming a very rewarding one. But that has taken a while to get there, really.
Could you share some of the ways that you found it to be a very rewarding experience, and some of the little delights that such life can involve?
Yeah, I think for us it's opened up a world, really, of special needs and disability. And so one of the things that we hugely enjoy and find incredibly emotional and exciting and rewarding is even like going along to our children's sports days. We were talking about it yesterday, but we have a little girl in Anna's class learnt to walk last year, and they involve all the children in this wheelchairs running up and down this race. And so she's pushed over bubble wrap, and she's weaved in and out and sped down to this finishing line. And then just a few feet from the finishing line, they get her out of her chair, and she really stumbles over the finishing line, and just the whole place erupts, really. And for us, being part of a world where children are valued like that, and is really exciting and a real eye-opener as well. And again, just I think we see a different way in which God values us as children, not based upon sometimes our own accomplishments. Sometimes we're wheeled right up to the finish line and we stumble right over it, and he delights in us anyway. And I think us kind of being introduced to that whole world of disability and special needs has had really joyful elements. And I mean, Sports Day is just one example.
Yeah, I think there's been, for me, there's been a lot of, this will sound very mundane in comparison, but there's just been a lot of comedy because of the way that the children behave. They just don't play by the same rules as other people. And even just the other morning, I come downstairs and Zeke says something like, "Daddy," because he's now speaking really well, and he's actually reading a bit as well. It's amazing. He got well beyond where we thought he might. But he just says, "Daddy, when we do things that are wrong, we say sorry and God forgives us." And I looked at him and I went, "Wow, Zeke," because I hadn't heard him say it. I said, "Well, you know, who told you that?" And he just looked at me and went, "Jesus." And he's just got this very sort of abrupt comic way of saying things. And he quotes the Bible all the time, and he tells other children that he's going to be the only king of the Jews. And that the other day I was telling him off for something, and he's really into the crucifixion story at the moment, and he threatened to take me to the place of the skull because he just doesn't realize that there's a distinction between the Bible and the stories that he watches on TV and the real world that he lives in. And so there's a lot of things like that as well, which are at a slightly more mundane day-to-day level, but just make things really bright and really humorous. So there's some serious stuff we've seen, but a lot of much more, you know, levity and joy and so on at a day-to-day level. The kids really come alive swimming. We love the way we do Christmas as a family. We love Zeke's birthday today. We love the way that we've had to do that together. And you reinvent everything. And in the first few years, you're just aware of what you've lost. But as we are beginning to get used to it now, as Rachel said, we see it as ordinary and in many ways a source of great joy. And we think we have all sorts of things that other families don't have.
One of the things that you speak about, Rachel, within the book that I found very helpful was the importance of appreciating the nature of your own mission field and learning to esteem the mission field that you have been given rather than the one that you, it may not be the one that you expected or the one that you aspire to, but it's a mission field that is valued by God and that is used by God. And in the same way, Andrew, you talk about the danger of individualitis and failing to recognise that our destiny is part of a bigger picture of which we're not necessarily the centre. And one of the things you talk about is, for instance, repairing the dung gate, that the gate with the rebuilding of Jerusalem, it needed to be built, but for the wall to survive, to be secure, every single gate needed to be secure, even the most... Yes, dishonourable gate, the gate that's associated with the dung, and the importance of doing unheard of things, the things that people aren't necessarily going to send back in the reports, but the things that God might see. Could you give some more thoughts about that, both of you? How you found it changing your notions of mission more generally?
Yeah, I think for me it's been a very humbling process. I don't think that's a process you ever come out the other side of, but I think certainly I've had to completely change the model of working for several years. I was doing quite a lot of traveling and speaking at things and almost all of which I had to cut back either completely or very dramatically in order to be able to make life work at home. And I think some of it was an ongoing tension. I thought, oh, I'm being stopped from doing things I should be doing because of this difficulty at home, and I resented some of it and had days, weeks, months even when I was just cross and a bit self-pitying about it. But I think on balance, looking at where we are now, I think seeing the dignity of some of the jobs that I wouldn't have chosen to do, and actually also the triviality of many of the jobs that I would have chosen to do. I think probably one of the things that surprised me is how relative to the amount of glamour you would attribute to them, some of the bigger things, at least in the world's eyes and in my eyes, that I was doing were actually much less significant. I think I got to the point of thinking, actually, the vast majority of times I get invited to go and speak at something, if I said no, somebody else would go along and do it at least as well, and in many cases better than I would. So the people of God have not suffered from me not doing this. And actually, some of the things which I really have to do, like being a husband to Rachel and father to Zeke and Anna, are the obvious ones. But even, it's, I think, made me a much better pastor in the local church. It's made me much more rooted in a local community and much more aware of the people around me and so on, and much less flitty in terms of off and around, as you know, I think you used the word earlier, gallivanting of Matt and Derek facetiously. But I think there was some gallivanting in me. I like the idea of being somewhere new, and I like, you know, new challenges all the time. But I think it wasn't necessarily the best way of building for the long haul for the kingdom of God. So I think for me that was one of the big things, just to praise my reappraise my notions of success and what kingdom ministry was, so that ordinary things got bigger and extraordinary things got smaller.
Yeah, I think I would agree, and I think what Andrew said about it being humbling has been so helpful in terms of a leadership context. I think both of us, before we had children and even when Zeke was a baby, would have had a concept of parenting and family life as being quite like a sausage factory, really, where what you put in is what you get out, and would have had no sense of the clay resisting the potter or whatever. And I think now we would be much slower to judge others, particularly when family life hasn't worked out as they would have wanted, or just have a different type of children, different types of families. But I think that's been a really positive thing for the church. And actually, I think sometimes there have been times, particularly when the children have been in a bad place, where it's been very hard to see that this could have been the best for them. But I think even when it comes to us, and we can already really see what God's done in us, how it's helped us, how it's helped the church for this to happen to our family. And I think we're getting there with the children, particularly with Zeke. We can see some of the brilliant strengths that he has, and part of that is to do with his condition as well. But that's been harder when they've been going backwards or having seizures. But yeah, it's been an interesting experience.
One of the most thought-provoking parts of the book I found was where you discuss the battle between entitlement and gratitude. Again, this ties in with Andrew's analogy about the orange, but the importance of cultivating thankfulness in a situation where our culture would make us think of thwarted rights or something like that. How have you found that as an important part of living in a situation where you're raising special needs children?
Yeah, I've found that really important, and something I've had to fight for at times. But I think actually being thankful rather than entitled has paradoxically made me a better advocate as well for the children. I don't think actually much gets done through angry advocacy on behalf of your children. And I've tried to, we've had so many appointments, not just with medical professionals, but with educational professionals and teachers. And I've tried to make that a real principle that I live by, really, that thankfulness that they could have been born anywhere. We could have been born anywhere. And actually, we are hugely blessed to have these children in a culture that values and esteems them, and that has provision for them as well. We are enormously blessed by the National Health Service and by the state school system, the special school system. So I think thankfulness has been really key, a key foundation to what's made things work for our family.
Yeah, I think we've got some friends who've got special needs kids in other parts of the world, and one who's got special needs kids in Turkey, and another one who's got special needs kids in the Russian-speaking world, Ukraine, and so on, and seeing the way that things are handled there. I think the vertical gratitude that you have to fight for, really, the sense of, I know before God I'm not entitled to any more than I have, actually does, and I think this is what Rage is reflecting, translates into horizontal gratitude as well. So you end up you begin going, I know I've got to get my head around the fact that what I deserve is death and condemnation, and instead I've received life. And you start there with the gospel, really. The centre of the gospel makes you grateful as you consider it, and your eschatological hope and all the rest compared to the what you have. So you stop feeling grumbly about what you have. But as that sets in your heart, it begins to spread sideways as well, and you become grateful rather than entitled to people, other people, you know, human organizations and institutions and the like, and start thinking, this isn't just that I'm thankful to God that he's given me this instead of eternal separation from God. And, you know, it's actually, it changes the way you think about gratitude towards other people as well, and you begin to become really happy and upbeat and excited about things that you realize other people assume is their right. But because of the way the gospel takes, and at least this is how it's supposed to work in theory, but the way the gospel works in your heart, it changes your attitude to services and provisions and benefits and all the rest of it, which, of course, if you're British and you have special needs kids, you have a staggering amount of help and support, probably much less for American listeners, I guess, from the state anyway. But it is just amazing to think, wow, God has blessed in so abundantly. But I think that starts with the gospel, beginning to look, you compare yourself with what you actually deserve, and you realize, this is just scandalous. I've got so much more than I should have. And as that seeps through bits of your life, it does begin to change. And I think, obviously, that's a very nice picture of it. It doesn't always feel like that, but I genuinely think I am a much more grateful person, and I have a much better theology of gift now than I did 3 years ago, because I'm learning to see gifts everywhere.
Both of you, towards the end of the book, turn the attention very much towards the future. Rachel, you talk about future grace and trusting God with the future. And Andrew, you talk about very much eschatological grace, new heavens and the new earth, and that expectation. How have you found your experience of Christian hope being sharpened and honed?
So I think one of the things it's done for me, looking at eschatology as not something which sort of happens to the world in the abstract, but will actually happen to me and my family. And I think seeing, it's an issue we come across with healing, that it's not a question of whether God will heal our kids, it's actually when. It's a question of, you know, when, it's not is God going to answer this, the cries of our hearts and so on, it's actually when and how is he going to, because the new creation is sort of restoration of all things, and I don't know what form that takes, I don't know what it looks like, but I know that God will make everything, you know, Sam's phrase in The Lord of the Rings, isn't it, everything sad will come untrue. I think that's sort of that all the enemies put under God's feet, and the last enemy to be destroyed is death. And I think you find yourself meditating a lot more on that when you are frustrated by the situation you're in now. I didn't first notice that when I was first started travelling to countries where most people were poor and had very little and were not happy in their lot. They sung far more songs and hymns about the future than we do in Britain. And I was very aware of that because I realised, oh, the less happy you are with your life now, the more you think about the future. And of course, all that's happened in the last few years is I've started living in that myself, realising there is a lot of things about the present, which either for myself, selfishly, and small-mindedly, or for the children, I feel this should not be this way. But I'm able to look forward to a day when I know that all wrongs will be righted. So for me, actually, that sort of eschatological, theological side of things has been a very important aspect of it. It probably translates, in my case, a little bit less into the day-to-day. Rach is probably, is that fair to say? You've got that slightly more on the day-to-day side.
Yeah, I think for me, the idea of future grace has been a hugely helpful one. I think partly because as humans, perhaps we're, even though we can look back over the last few years, let alone into the gospel of grace as well, but and see that God has been gracious and provided, and that there have been gifts as we've needed them. They've come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes, whether that's in family living nearby, or intervention from professionals or friends around us, or people who've had the same experiences. And yet, even though God has been so gracious, sometimes I can still unwittingly kind of forecast a future for me or for Andrew, for the children, that is devoid of his grace. And I don't know why I continue to do that, really. But it's so helpful to, as a discipline, look back and look at his track record, really, of gracious provision in our life, and to fast forward that forward. I think probably really for me, in terms of faith, where the rubber hits the road for that is knowing that one day, you know, obviously one day we will not be here and our children will, presumably. And that's where I really have to trust God, that at the moment I and Andrew are the main kind of conduits of his grace to them. And at some point that those conduits are going to look different and they will be better suited to that moment. But that's a real issue of faith. We're also expecting our third child. I'm about 3.5 months pregnant, and there's no scan or blood test for autism and epilepsy or ADHD. So that's a real issue of faith and faith in future grace, really, that we won't know for 2 or 3 years whether or not we have a third child with special needs, and that is a possibility. So really, we're just going into a season of uncertainty, and clinging to future grace is really relevant to where we are now.
Can you give any very practical suggestions on how Christians and others can respond and help and be present to and with friends and relatives whose children are affected by disabilities?
Yeah, I think there's a few things to say on that, really. The first, I think, we are so desperate to reassure people, and I know that I got a lot of reassurance from people. Oh no, everything's fine.
including me, I should say. I was probably the worst candidate, and going, no, there's no problem here, because I didn't want to believe that it might be.
Yeah, and I think I know that we rush to do that, but sometimes that's not the right reaction. To reassure immediately without thinking isn't always the most helpful thing. I think once someone does have a diagnosis, it's helpful, I think, for people to accept that quickly. And also, for us, we found the people that said, I'm so sorry, or that's so tough, I'm so sorry you're going through this, and didn't follow it up very quickly with a but, or an at least, or well, at least you won't have this problem, or oh, but she does have beautiful hair, was always a good one that we had a few times with Anna. Sometimes it's fine just to stop after saying, that's really tough, I'm praying for you, I'm thinking of you. Also, I found just practical help that was given without any expectation of being kept in the loop, or even any expectation that person would then choose to cry on your shoulder or to confide in you, or that you would be a first source of communication from that point, was so helpful. People who just literally left dinners on our doorstep without even asking if we needed them, just left them there, and didn't expect long phone conversations about where we were up to with the kids, or emotional outpourings in return. We were so grateful for that, and we actually had a very good experience from friends, relatives and the church when the children were diagnosed, and we so appreciate that. But I think, yeah, acts of service without any expectation in return have been a real lifeline. And also, I think just accepting decisions and giving leeway, really, for turning up to things late, leaving things early, perhaps not celebrating Christmas in exactly the same way. Our families have been great at being very quick to understand and help us through that.
Yeah, I think this probably applies to suffering more generally, any difficult situation more generally, but the thing Rachel said about us trying to process our own doubts and concerns and why has God let this happen things through people who are going through them is so common. And I think I just see that pastorally as well as personally. We're just rushed to go, oh, I'm sure it's fine, I'm sure they'll get better, and I'm sure, oh, isn't this lovely, there's so many strengths and so many good things here. All of which are kind of true, but they're often not the best thing to say. And yeah, that must be hard, or that's difficult, or even what are they like? We found that, people wanting to see Zeke and say, oh, but they're doing great. You know, they're really, lots of autistic people are very high functioning, aren't they? And those sorts of comments, which are obviously all very well intentioned, but probably more useful, is just, so what are they like? What do they dislike? What helps them? You know, what could I, if I saw them, what would be good? And quite often, I mean, we were joking about it yesterday, when we first filled out a form for Anna to go to school, the form said, what does Anna like and dislike? And Rachel had written a few things she likes, and then under dislikes, had just written being spoken to. And actually the reality is that sometimes that's true for people at a stage, and you almost just need people to go, okay, all right, well, if you don't want me to talk to you, then I won't look to try and get affection by getting in your face, I'll actually just leave you to it. And the people who've handled our kids best have often been like that. They've just been okay with being yelled at or cried at by a child, and then they just walk off and go, oh, all right then. They're often the people now that the children have the best relationships with. So that's a very kind of practical thing that probably applies in lots of contexts, but I think that's probably worth saying too.
One of the struggles, I suppose, with suffering and continued struggles, perhaps especially, is the struggle to be with people in that situation and to persevere together through an experience. Suffering tends to drive us apart and we go into our own separate experiences of dealing with it. How have you found the struggle of staying together and strengthening your marriage together as a couple through this experience, and also strengthening your relationship with other Christians?
Other Christians has been quite easy, actually, because as we've just been saying, I think people have been, around us anyway, pretty understanding and pretty good at that, and we've needed to draw on them for friendship and things, but our friendship shapes have changed according to availability in the evenings because we were up very early, that kind of thing. I think marriage-wise, I think Rachel's got far more to say than I have, because I think I have been much more difficult to live with than she has. And I think I'd handle this kind of stuff quite apocalyptically and sort of have these big explosions and then it sort of settles for a while and I begin to realise I was a bit stupid and maybe need to take things a bit easier. Rach processes things a bit more over a slow burn kind of thing. I think, though, I was very slow to realise how bad it was, actually. It sounds silly, but I thought, we've got to press through this. We can't have this dictating our lives kind of thing. And got to a bit of a crisis point where I just realised Rach could not cope and I needed to stop doing everything I was doing that wasn't absolutely essential, out of normal working hours, cut it all right back, stop doing everything for 6 months, and just work on trying to build a more robust family life. And as we did that, in response to some advice, some prophetic words we'd had, and just seeing the need in one another, I think God began to form us into a stronger unit. But there was a period there when I was not being very helpful as a husband to her, so she's probably got more to say on that.
I don't know that I'm always that easy to live with either. I think the slow burn thing is challenging in different ways, but I think for us it was really liberating the moment we realised we are not a normal, in inverted commas, family, and stopped trying to live as if we were. And that was hugely helpful. So we find that doing things, that other families do, is actually impossible sometimes. So we don't take the kids Christmas shopping, and we don't do all of those things. But we found a new ordinary, and a new normal has been the right thing for our family. And I think we call it the survival zone as well. That was a really helpful idea when we came across it. We just felt like there are times, particularly when Anna had been in hospital as a baby, where we would move into the survival zone and it would be about daily showering, eating. Everybody is alive at the end of the day, and that makes it a successful day. And then we'd move somewhere outside of that and we'd start to invest more in our marriage. And then we'd move outside of that and we'd even think about serving others through what we'd been through. And I think that the challenge with the survival zone is that you never know when you're about to re-enter it, and you've got to respond quickly, I think. And that's going to be our challenge over the coming years, I think, particularly with having another child, is to respond in a quicker way to realising that we need to rein commitments in, and that we and social stuff, having people out for dinner and stuff, that all goes when we're in the survival zone. But that's been quite a helpful concept to us, and not just to carry on as if everything's normal.
We're going to have to draw to a close. Unfortunately, our time is up. But I was wondering, just in conclusion, if you'd be able to give our listeners prayer points that we could pray for you, each of you individually as a couple, for each of your children, and then for all of you as a family. What are some of the ways we can pray for you?
For me, the main thing really is the baby that we're having. We just love the baby to be both obviously healthy. We pray for that. The baby would be kept safe. I think that's the main thing I'm praying for myself. And that actually as a family we would figure out how to flourish together if we have a child who is completely in quotes normal, and our two kids, that we'd be able to serve all of those children really well. I think in some ways at the moment, because there's two autistic children and they've got relatively similar needs a lot of the time and they like similar-ish things and they're the same age, you actually, it's almost easier to serve them than it would be one autistic one and one kind of non-autistic one. I think what we may have, God willing, is a child who's okay, completely normal, and then two autistic ones of varying degrees of severity. And I think figuring out what family life looks like in a way that all of them are really flying in life and getting the best out of it that they can is going to be a challenge. And I think we just need grace for that, really, and wisdom. But at the moment, I think it's just prayer for the baby to be well and healthy and for everything to go well with the pregnancy. I think that's very kind of you to ask, but that's probably what I would say.
Yeah, I think I'd just add to that as well, provision, in that we know for our family in particular, we depend upon other adult help and other adult support, really, and just for God to provide the right adults at the right time to be kind of around our family, to be helping. That might mean having, it might well mean having someone live with us, and we really need God's provision in that. So that's one other prayer point. That would be fantastic if people could pray.
Thank you. And thank you so much for joining us to discuss this. Where can listeners find your book, and what titles should they be looking for?
Well, if they're UK, it's called The Life You Never Expected, and it's in all the normal places online and bookshops and so on. I'm sure it's at Amazon and Eden and all the other kind of places. In the US, it's not coming out till June. Crossware publishing it there, and it's with the title "The Life We Never Expected," and the subtitle is different, but I'm sure you'd find it on that. And that's coming out in June, published Crossway. So we're really excited about that as well, knowing a lot of our listeners are American. So, but yeah, thanks so much, Alistair, as well. It's just really great to be able to talk in quite a different way like this. It's been very helpful, and I'm really grateful for you giving us the airtime to talk about it.
Thank you very much to Andrew and to Rachel, and also to all of our listeners. We hope that you enjoyed the episode, and that you will, if you have enjoyed it, that you will rate and write a review about us. And we pray that you will have a very good week. God bless you all.